Welcome to the Locked Room. I'm Mardell. And now we'll hear The Case of the Missing Hand by Arthur Morrison, Part 2. We climbed the rising ground, and presently, among the trees, came to the place where the little rill emerged from the broken ground in the highest part of the wood. Here the clean ground ceased, and there was a large patch of wet clayey earth. Several marks left by the feet of cattle were there, and one or two human footmarks. Two of these, a pair, the newest and the most distinct. Hewitt studied carefully and measured each direction. "Notice these marks," he said. "They may be of importance, or they may not. That we shall see. Fortunately, they are very distinctive. The right boot is a badly worn one, and a small tag of leather, where the sole is damaged, is doubled over and trodden into the soft earth. Nothing could be luckier. Clearly, they are the most recent footsteps in this direction from the main road, which lies right ahead through the rest of the wood." "Then you think somebody else has been on the scene of the tragedy, besides the victim and the brothers?" I said. "Yes, I do, but hark. There is a vehicle in the road. Can you see between the trees?" "Yes, it is the police cart. We shall be able to report its arrival to Mr. Hardwick as we go down." We turned and walked rapidly down the incline to where we had come from. Mr. Hardwick and his man were still there, and another rustic had arrived to gape. We told Mr. Hardwick that he might expect the police presently, and proceeded along the gravel skirting the stream toward the lower part of the wood. Here, Hewitt proceeded very cautiously, keeping a sharp lookout on either side for footprints on the neighboring soft ground. There were none, however, for the gravel margin of the stream made a sort of footpath of itself, and the trees and undergrowth were close and thick on each side. At the bottom, we emerged from the wood on a small piece of open ground skirting a lane, and here, just by the side of the lane where the stream fell into a trench, Hewitt suddenly pounced on another footmark. He was unusually excited. "See," he said, "here it is, the right foot with its broken leather, and the corresponding left foot on the damp edge of the lane itself. He, the man with the broken shoe, has walked on the hard gravel all the way down from the source of the stream, and his is the only trail unaccounted for near the body. Come, Brett, we've an adventure on foot. Do you care to let your uncle's dinner go by the board and follow?" "Can't we go back and tell him?" "No, there's no time to lose. We must follow up this man, or at least I must. You go or stay, of course, as you think best." I hesitated a moment, picturing to myself the excellent colonel as he would appear after waiting dinner an hour or two for us, but decided to go. "At any rate," I said, "if the way lies along the roads, we shall probably meet somebody going in the direction of Ratherby who will take a message. But what is your theory? I don't understand at all. I must say everything Hardwick said seemed to me to be beyond question. There were the tracks to prove that the three had walked together to the spot, and that the brothers had gone on alone, and every other circumstance pointed the same way. Then what possible motive could anybody else about here have for such a crime? Unless, indeed, it were one of the people defrauded by Sneathy's late companies." "The motive," said Hewitt, "is, I fancy, a most extraordinary, indeed, a weird one. A thing as of centuries ago. Ask me no questions. I think you will be a little surprised before very long, but come, we must move." And we mended our pace along the lane. The lane, by the by, was hard and firm, with scarcely a spot where a track might be left, except in places at the sides, and at these places Hewitt never gave a glance. At the end of the lane, it turned into a by-road, and at the turning, Hewitt stopped and scrutinized the ground closely. There was nothing like a recognizable footmark to be seen. But almost immediately Hewitt turned off to the right, and we continued our brisk march without a glance at the road. "How did you judge which way to turn, then?" I asked. "Didn't you see?" replied Hewitt. "I'll show you at the next turning." Half a mile farther on, the road forked, and here Hewitt stooped and pointed silently to a couple of small twigs placed crosswise, with the longer twig of the two pointing down the branch of the road to the left. We took the branch to the left and went on. "Our man's making a mistake," Hewitt observed. "He leaves his friend's messages lying about for his enemies to read." We hurried forward with scarcely a word. I was almost too bewildered by what Hewitt had said and done to formulate anything like a reasonable guess as to what our expedition tended, or even to make an effective inquiry, though after what Hewitt had said, I knew that would be useless. Who was this mysterious man with the broken shoe? What had he to do with the murder of Sneathy? What did the mutilation mean? And who were his friends who left him signs and messages by means of crossed twigs? We met a man by whom I sent a short note to my uncle, and soon after we turned into a main road. Here, again, at the corner, was the curious message of twigs. A cartwheel had passed over and crushed them, but it had not so far displaced them as to cause any doubt that the direction to take was to the right. At an inn a little farther along, we entered, and Hewitt bought a pint of Irish whiskey and a flat bottle to hold it in, as well as a loaf of bread and some cheese, which we carried away wrapped in paper. "This will have to do for our dinner," Hewitt said as we emerged. "But we're not going to drink a pint of common whiskey between us," I asked in some astonishment. "Never mind," Hewitt answered with a smile. "Perhaps we'll find somebody to help us. Somebody not so fastidious as yourself as to quality." Now we hurried more than ever, for it was beginning to get dusk, and Hewitt feared a difficulty in finding and reading the twig signs in the dark. Two more turnings we made, each with its silent direction, the crossed twigs. To me there was something almost weird and creepy in this curious hunt for the invisible and the incomprehensible, guided faithfully and persistently at every turn by this now unmistakable signal. After the second turning, we broke into a trot along a long, winding lane, but presently Hewitt's hand fell on my shoulder and we stopped. He pointed ahead, where some large object round a bend of the hedge was illuminated as though by a light from below. "We will walk now," Hewitt said. "Remember that we are on a walking tour and have come along here entirely by accident." We proceeded at a swinging walk, Hewitt whistling gaily. Soon we turned the bend and saw that the large object was a traveling van drawn up with two others on a space of grass by the side of the lane. It was a gypsy encampment, the caravan having apparently only lately stopped, for a man was still engaged in tugging at the rope of a tent that stood near the vans. Two or three sullen-looking ruffians lay about a fire which burned in the space left in the middle of the encampment. A woman stood at the door of one van with a large kettle in her hand, and at the foot of the steps below her, a more pleasant-looking old man sat on an inverted pail. Hewitt swung towards the fire from the road, and with an indescribable mixture of slouch, bow, and smile, addressed the company generally with a "Kush du bock, pals!" The men on the ground took no notice, but continued to stare doggedly before them. The man working at the tent looked round quickly for a moment, and the old man on the bucket looked up and nodded. Quick to see the most likely friend, Hewitt at once went up to the old man, extending his hand. "Sharshan, Dado," he said, "del mandy tudis varst." The old man smiled and shook hands, though without speaking. Then Hewitt proceeded, producing the flat bottle of whiskey. "Taddy for Pawnee, Charles! Tell Mandy the Pawnee and little Posh the Taddy!" The whiskey did it. We were Romany Rise in 20 minutes or less, and had already been taking tea with the gypsies for half the time. The two or three we had found about the fire were still reserved, but these I found were only half-gypsies and understood very little Romany. One or two others, however, including the old man, were of purer breed and talked freely, as did one of the women. They were Lees, they said, and expected to be on Worksby racehorse in 3 days' time. "We, too, were Peary Mengroves or travelers," Hewitt explained, "and might look to see them on the course." Then he fell to telling gypsy stories, and they to telling others back, to my intense mystification. Hewitt explained afterwards that they were mostly stories of poaching, with now and then a horse-coping anecdote thrown in. Since then I have learned enough of Romany to take my part in such a conversation, but at the time a word or two, here and there, was all I could understand. In all this talk, the man we had first noticed stretching the tent rope took very little interest, but lay with his head away from the fire, smoking his pipe. He was a much darker man than any other present, had, in fact, the appearance of a man of even a swarthier race than that of the others about us. Presently, in the middle of a long and, of course, to me, unintelligible story by the old man, I caught Hewitt's eye. He lifted one eyebrow almost imperceptibly and glanced for a single moment at his walking stick. Then I saw that it was pointed toward the feet of the very dark man who had not yet spoken. One leg was thrown over the other as he lay, with the soles of his shoes presented toward the fire, and in its glare I saw that the right sole was worn and broken, and that a small triangular tag of leather was doubled over beneath in just the place we knew of from the prints in Ratherby Wood. I could not take my eyes off that man with a broken shoe. There lay the secret, the whole mystery of the fantastic crime in Ratherby Wood, centered in that shabby ruffian. But what was it? But Hewitt went on talking and joking furiously. The men who were not speaking mostly smoked gloomily, but whenever one spoke, he became animated and lively. I had attempted once or twice to join in, though my efforts were not particularly successful, except in inducing one man to offer me tobacco from his box, tobacco that almost made me giddy in the smell. He tried some of mine in exchange, and though he praised it with native politeness and smoked the pipe through, I could see that my hignett mixture was poor stuff in his estimation, compared with the awful tobacco in his own box. Presently the man with the broken shoe got up, slouched over to his tent, and disappeared. Then said Hewitt, I translate, "You're not all Lees here, I see. Yes, pal, all Lees. But he's not a Lees," and Hewitt jerked his head toward the tent. "Why not a Lee, pal? We be Lees. He is with us, thus he is a Lee." "Oh, well, yes, of course, but I know he is over from the Pawnee. Come on, I'll guess the Tim. He comes from, is from Rumania, eh? Perhaps the Wallachian part?" The men looked at one another, and then the old Lee said, "You're right, pal. You're cleverer than we took you for. And that is what they call his Tim. He is a Petulengro, and he comes with us to shoe the grease and mend the wardos. But he is with us, and so he is a Lee." The talk and the smoke went on. And presently the man with the broken shoe returned and lay down again. Then, when the whiskey had all gone, and Hewitt, with some excuse that I did not understand, had begged a piece of cord from one of the men, we left in a chorus of couche to rarities. By this time it was nearly 10 o'clock. We walked briskly till we came back to the inn where we had bought the whiskey. Here Hewitt, after some little trouble, succeeded in hiring a village cart. and while the driver was harnessing the horse, cut a couple of short sticks from the hedge. These, being divided into two, made four short, stout pieces of something less than 6 inches long apiece. Then Hewitt joined them together in pairs, each pair being connected from center to center by about 9 or 10 inches of the cord he had brought from the gypsies' camp. These done, he handed one pair to me. "Handcuffs," he explained, "and no bad ones either. See, you use them so." And he passed the cord round my wrist, gripping the two handles and giving them a slight twist that sufficiently convinced me of the excruciating pain that might be inflicted by a vigorous turn and of the utter helplessness of a prisoner thus secured in the hands of captors prepared to use their instruments. "Whom are these for?" I asked. "The man with the broken shoe?" Hewitt nodded. "Yes," he said, "I expect we shall find him out alone about midnight. You know how to use these now." It was fully 11 before the cart was ready, and we started. A quarter of a mile or so from the gypsy encampment, Hewitt stopped the cart and gave the driver instructions to wait. We got through the hedge and made our way on the soft ground behind it in the direction of the vans and the tent.
"Roll up your handkerchief," Hewitt whispered, "into a tight pad. The moment I grab him, ram it into his mouth, well in, mind, so that it doesn't easily fall out. Probably he will be stooping. That will make it easier. We can pull him suddenly backward. Now be quiet."
We kept on till nothing but the hedge divided us from the space whereon stood the encampment. It was now nearer 12 o'clock than 11, but the time we waited seemed endless. But time is not eternity, after all, and at last we heard a move in the tent. A minute after, the man we sought was standing before us. He made straight for a gap in the hedge, which we had passed on our way, and we crouched low and waited. He emerged on our side of the hedge with his back towards us and began walking, as we had walked, behind the hedge, but in the opposite direction. We followed. He carried something in his hand that looked like a large bundle of sticks and twigs, and he appeared to be as anxious to be secret as we ourselves. From time to time he stopped and listened. Fortunately, there was no moon, or in turning about as he did once or twice, he would probably have observed us. The field sloped downward just before us, and there was another hedge at right angles, leading down to a slight hollow. To this hollow the man made his way, and in the shade of the new hedge we followed. Presently he stopped suddenly, stooped, and deposited his bundle on the ground before him. Crouching before it, he produced matches from his pocket, struck one, and in a moment had a fire of twigs and small branches that sent up a heavy white smoke. What all this portended I could not imagine, but a sense of the weirdness of the whole adventure came upon me unchecked. The horrible corpse in the wood with its severed wrist, Hewitt's enigmatical forebodings, the mysterious tracking of the man with the broken shoe, the scene round the gypsy's fire, and now the strange behavior of this man, whose connection with the tragedy was so intimate and yet so inexplicable. All these things contributed to make up a tale of but a few hours' duration, but of an inscrutable impressiveness that I began to feel in my nerves. The man bent a thin stick double, and using it as a pair of tongs, held some indistinguishable object over the flames before him. Excited as I was, I could not help noticing that he bent and held the stick with his left hand. We crept stealthily nearer, and as I stood scarcely 3 yards behind him, and looked over his shoulder, the form of the object stood out clear and black against the dull red of the flame. It was a human hand. I suppose I may have somehow betrayed my amazement and horror to my companion's sharp eyes, for suddenly I felt his hand tightly grip my arm just above the elbow. I turned and found his face close by mine and his finger raised warningly. Then I saw him produce his wrist grip
and make a motion with his palm toward his mouth, which I understood to be intended to remind me of the gag. We stepped forward. The man turned his horrible cookery over and over above the crackling sticks, as though to smoke and dry it in every part. I saw Hewitt's hand reach out toward him, and in a flash we had pulled him back over his heels, and I had driven the gag between his teeth as he opened his mouth. We seized his wrists and the cords at once, and I shall never forget the man's look of ghastly, frantic terror as he lay on the ground. When I knew more, I understood the reason of this. Hewitt took both wrist holds in one hand and drove the gag entirely into the man's mouth so that he almost choked. A piece of sacking lay near the fire, and by Hewitt's request, I dropped that awful hand from the wooden twigs upon it and rolled it up in a parcel. It was no doubt what the sacking had been brought for. Then we lifted the man to his feet and hurried him in the direction of the cart. The whole capture could not have occupied 30 seconds, and as I stumbled over the rough field at the man's left elbow, I could only think of the thing as one thinks of a dream that one knows all the time is a dream. But presently the man, who had been walking quietly, though gasping, sniffing, and choking because of the tightly rolled handkerchief in his mouth, presently he made a sudden dive, thinking doubtless to get his wrists free by surprise, but Hewitt was alert, and gave them a twist that made him roll his head with a dismal, stifled yell. And with the opening of his mouth, by some chance, the gag fell away, and immediately the man roared aloud for help. "Quick," said Hewitt, "drag him along, they'll hear in the vans. Bring the hand." I seized the fallen handkerchief and crammed it over the man's mouth as well as I might, and together we made as much of a trot as we could, dragging the man between us, while Hewitt checked any reluctance on his part by a timely wrench of the wrist holds. It was a hard 250 yards to the lane, even for us. For the gypsy, it must have been a bad minute and a half indeed. Once more, as we went over the uneven ground, he managed to get out a shout, and we thought we heard a distinct reply from somewhere in the direction of the encampment. We pulled him over a stile in a tangle, and dragged and pushed him through a small hedge gap all in a heap. Here we were but a short distance from the cart, and into that we flung him without wasting time or tenderness, to the intense consternation of the driver, who I believe very nearly set up a cry for help on his own account. Once in the cart, however, I seized the reins and the whip myself, and leaving Hewitt to take care of the prisoner, put the turnout along toward Ratherby, as near 10 miles an hour as it could go. We made first for Mr. Hardwick's, but he, we found, was with my uncle, so we followed him. The arrest of the Fosters had been effected, we learned, not very long after we had left the wood, as they returned by another route to Ramworth. We brought our prisoner into the colonel's library, where he and Mr. Hardwick were sitting. "I'm not quite sure what we can charge him with unless it's anatomical robbery," Hewitt remarked, "but here's the criminal." The man only looked down, with a sulkily impenetrable countenance. Hewitt spoke to him once or twice, and at last he said in a strange accent something that sounded like "Kekkenjen Navi." "Kekkenjen," asked Hewitt in the loud, clear tone one instinctively adopts in talking to a foreigner. "Kekeno Jenny!" The man understood and shook his head, but not another word would he say, or another question answer. "He's a foreign gypsy," Hewitt explained, "just as I thought, a Wallachian, in fact. Theirs is an older and purer dialect than that of the English gypsies, and only some of the root words are alike. But I think we can make him explain tomorrow that the Fosters, at least, had nothing to do with, at any rate, cutting off Sneedy's hand. Here it is, I think." And he gingerly lifted the folds of sacking from the ghastly object as it lay on the table, and then covered it up again.
"But what does it all mean?" Mr. Hardwick said in bewildered astonishment. "Do you mean this man was an accomplice?"
"Not at all. The case was one of suicide, as I think you'll agree when I've explained.
This man simply found the body hanging and stole the hand.
But what in the world for?
For the hand of glory, eh? He turned to the gypsy and pointed to the hand on the table. Yagvarste? There was a quick gleam of intelligence in the man's eye, but he said nothing. As for myself, I was more than astounded. Could it be possible that the old superstition of the hand of glory remained alive in a practical shape at this day? You know the superstition, of course, Hewitt said. It did exist in this country in the last century, when there were plenty of dead men hanging at crossroads and so on. On the continent, in some places, it has survived later. Among the Wallachian gypsies, it has always been a great article of belief, and the superstition is still quite active. The belief is that the right hand of a hanged man, cut off and dried over the smoke of certain wood and herbs, and then provided with wicks at each finger made of the dead man's hair, becomes, when lighted at each wick, the wicks are greased, of course, a charm whereby a thief may walk without hindrance where he pleases in a strange house, push open all doors, and take what he likes. Nobody can stop him, for everybody the hand of glory approaches is made helpless and can neither move nor speak. You may remember there was some talk of thieves' candles in connection with a horrible series of Whitechapel murders not long ago. That is only one form of the cult of the hand of glory.
Yes, my uncle said, I remember reading so, and there is a story about it in the Ingoldsby legends, too, I believe.
There is. It is called the hand of glory, in fact. You remember the spell. Open lock to the dead man's knock, and so on, but I think you'd better have the constable up and get this man into safe quarters for the night. He should be searched, of course. I expect they will find on him the hair I noticed to have been cut from Sneathy's head.
The village constable arrived, with his iron handcuffs in substitution for those of cord which had so sorely vexed the wrist of our prisoner, and marched him away to the little lock-up on the green. Then my uncle and Mr. Hardwick turned on Martin Hewitt with doubts and many questions.
"Why do you call it suicide?" Mr. Hardwick asked. "It is plain. The Fosters were with him at the time from the tracks. Do you mean to say that they stood there and watched Sneathy hang himself without interfering?"
"No, I don't," Hewitt replied, lighting a cigar. "I think I told you that they never saw Sneathy."
"Yes, you did, and of course that's what they said themselves when they were arrested. But the thing's impossible. Look at the tracks."
The tracks are exactly what revealed to me that it was not impossible, Hewitt returned. I'll tell you how the case unfolded itself to me from the beginning. As to the information you gathered from the Ranworth coachman to begin with, the conversation between the Fosters which he overheard might well mean something less serious than murder. What did they say? They had been sent for in a hurry, and had just had a short consultation with their mother and sister. Henry said that the thing must be done at once, also that there were two of them, it should be easy. Robert said that Henry, as a doctor, would know best what to do. Now, you, Colonel Brett, had been saying, before we learned these things from Mr. Hardwick, that Sneathy's behavior of late had become so bad as to seem that of a madman. Then there was the story of his sudden attack on a tradesman in the village, and equally sudden running away, exactly the sort of impulsive wild thing that madmen do. Why, then, might it not be reasonable to suppose that Sneathy had become mad? More especially considering all the circumstances of the case, his commercial ruin and disgrace, and his horrible life with his wife and her family, had become suddenly much worse and quite uncontrollable, so that the two wretched women left alone with him were driven to send in haste for Henry and Robert to help them. That would account for all. The brothers arrived just after Sneathy had gone out. They are told in a hurried interview how affairs stand, and it is decided that Sneathy must at once be secured and confined in an asylum before something serious happens. He's just gone out. Something terrible may be happening at this moment. The brothers determined to follow at once and secure him wherever he may be. Then the meaning of their conversation is plain. The thing that must be done at once is the capture of Sneathy and his confinement in an asylum. Henry, as a doctor, would know what to do in regard to the necessary formalities. And they took a halter in case a struggle should ensue, and it were found necessary to bind him. Very likely, wasn't it?
Well, yes, Mr. Hardwick replied, it certainly is. It never struck me in that light at all.
That was because you believed to begin with that a murder had been committed, and looked at the preliminary circumstances which you learned after in the light of your conviction. But now, to come to my actual observations, I saw the footmarks across the fields, and agreed with you. It was indeed obvious that Sneathy had gone that way first, and that the brothers had followed, walking over his tracks. This state of the tracks continued until well into the wood, when suddenly the tracks of the brothers opened out and proceeded on each side of Sneathy's. The simple inference would seem to be, of course, the one you made, that the Fosters had here overtaken Sneathy and walked one at each side of him. But of this I felt by no means certain. Another very simple explanation was available, which might chance to be the true one. It was just at the spot where the brothers' tracks separated that the path became suddenly much muddier because of the closer overhanging of the trees on the spot. The path was, as was to be expected, wettest in the middle. It would be the most natural thing in the world for two well-dressed young men on arriving here to separate so as to walk one on each side of the mud in the middle. On the other hand, a man in Sneathy's state, assuming him for the moment to be mad and contemplating suicide, would walk straight along the center of the path, taking no note of mud or anything else. I examined all the tracks very carefully, and my theory was confirmed. The feet of the brothers had everywhere alighted in the driest spots, and the steps were of irregular lengths, which meant, of course, that they were picking their way, while Sneathy's footmarks had never turned aside even for the dirtiest puddle. Here, then, were the rudiments of a theory. At the watercourse, of course, the footmarks ceased, because of the hard gravel. The body lay on a knoll at the left, a knoll covered with grass. On this, the signs of footmarks were almost undiscoverable, though I am often able to discover tracks in grass that are invisible to others. Here, however, it was almost useless to spend much time in examination, for you and your man had been there, and what slight marks there might be would be indistinguishable one from another. Under the branch from which the man had hung, there was an old tree stump with a flat top, where the tree had been sawn off. I examined this, and it became fairly apparent that Sneathy had stood on it when the rope was about his neck. His muddy footprint was plain to see. The mud was not smeared about, you see, as it probably would have been if he had been stood there forcibly and pushed off. It was a simple, clear footprint. Another hint at suicide. But then arose the objection that you mentioned yourself. Plainly, the brothers Foster were following Sneathy and came this way. Therefore, if he hanged himself before they arrived, it would seem that they must have come across the body. But now, I examined the body itself. There was mud on the knees, and clinging to one knee was a small leaf. It was a leaf corresponding to those on the bush behind the tree, and it was not a dead leaf, so must have been just detached. After my examination of the body, I went to the bush, and there, in the thick of it, were for me sufficiently distinct nail marks, in one of which the knee had crushed a spray of the brush against the ground, and from that spray a leaf was missing. Behind the knee marks were the indentations of boot toes in the soft, bare earth under the bush, and thus the thing was plain. The poor lunatic had come in sight of the dangling rope, and the temptation to suicide was irresistible. To people in a deranged state of mind, the mere sight of a means of self-destruction is often a temptation impossible to withstand. But at that moment he must have heard the steps, probably the voices, of the brothers behind him on the winding path. He immediately hid in the bush till they had passed. It is probable that seeing who the men were and conjecturing that they were following him, thinking also perhaps of things that had occurred between them and himself, his inclination to self-destruction became completely ungovernable, with the result that you saw. But before I inspected the bush, I noticed one or two more things about the body. You remember I inquired if either of the brothers, Foster, was left-handed, and was assured that neither was. But clearly the hand had been cut off by a left-handed man with a large, sharply pointed knife. For well away to the right of where the wrist had hung, the knife point had made a tiny triangular rent in the coat, so that the hand must have been held in the mutilator's right hand while he used the knife with his left. Clearly, a left-handed man. But most important of all about the body was the jagged hair over the right ear. Everywhere else the hair was well cut and orderly. Here it seemed as though a good piece had been, so to speak, sawn off. What could anybody want with a dead man's right hand and certain locks of his hair? Then it struck me suddenly the man was hanged. It was the Hand of Glory. Then you will remember I went at your request to see the footprints of the Fosters on the part of the path past the watercourse. Here again it was muddy in the middle, and the two brothers had walked as far apart as before, although nobody had walked between them. A final proof, if one were needed, of my theory as to the three lines of footprints. Now I was to consider how to get at the man who had taken his hand. He should be punished for the mutilation, but beyond that he would be required as a witness. Now all the foot tracks in the vicinity had been accounted for. There were those of the brothers and of Sneathy, which we have been speaking of, those of the rustics looking on, which, however, stopped a little way off and did not interfere with our sphere of observation, those of your man who had cut straight through the wood when he first saw the body and had come back the same way with you, and our own, which we had been careful to keep away from the others. Consequently, there was no track of the man who had cut off the hand. Therefore, it was certain that he must have come along the hard gravel by the watercourse, for that was the only possible path which would not tell the tale. Indeed, it seemed quite a likely path through the wood for a passenger to take, coming from the high ground by the Shopperton Road. Brett and I left you and traversed the watercourse both up and down. We found a footprint at the top, left lately by a man with a broken shoe. Right down to the bottom of the watercourse, where it emerged from the wood, there was no sign on either side of this man having left the gravel. Where the body was, as you will remember, he would simply have stepped off the gravel onto the grass, which I thought it useless to examine, as I have explained, but at the bottom by the lane the footprint appeared again. This, then, was the direction in which I was to search for a left-handed man with a broken-soled shoe. Probably a gypsy, and most probably a foreign gypsy, because a foreign gypsy would be the most likely still to hold the belief in the Hand of Glory. I conjectured the man to be a straggler from a band of gypsies, one who probably had got behind the caravan and had made a shortcut across the wood after it. So at the end of the lane I looked for a patrin. This is a sign that the gypsies leave to guide stragglers following up. Sometimes it is a heap of dead leaves, sometimes a few stones, sometimes a mark on the ground, but more usually a couple of twigs crossed, with the longer twig pointing the road. Guided by these patrons, we came in the end on the gypsy camp, just as it was settling down for the night.
We made ourselves agreeable, as Brett will probably describe to you better than I can. We left them, and after they had gone to sleep, we came back and watched for the gentleman who was now in the lockup. He would, of course, seize the first opportunity of treating his ghastly trophy in the prescribed way, and I guessed he would choose midnight, for that is the time the superstition teaches that the hand should be prepared. We made a few small preparations, collared him, and now you've got him, and I should think the sooner you let the brothers Foster go, the better. But why didn't you tell me all the conclusions you had arrived at the time? Asked Mr. Hardwick. Well, really, Hewitt replied with a quiet smile, you were so positive, and some of the traces I relied on were so small that it would probably have meant a long argument and a loss of time. But more than that, confess, if I had told you bluntly that Sneathy's hand had been taken away to make a medieval charm, to enable a thief to pass through a locked door and steal plate calmly under the owner's nose, what would you have said? Well, perhaps I should have been a little skeptical. Appearances combined so completely to point to the Fosters as murderers that any other explanation almost would have seemed unlikely to me, and that, well, no, I confess, I shouldn't have believed in it. But it is a startling thing to find such superstitions alive nowadays. Yes, perhaps it is, yet we find survivals of the sort very frequently. The Wallachians, however, are horribly superstitious still. The gypsies among them are, of course, worse. Don't you remember the case reported a few months ago, in which a child was drowned as a sacrifice in Wallachia in order to bring rain? And that was not done by gypsies, either. Even in England, as late as 1865, a poor, paralyzed Frenchman was killed by being swum for witchcraft, and that was in Essex. And less atrocious cases of belief in wizardry occur again and again, even now. Then Mr. Hardwick and my uncle fell into a discussion as to how the gypsy in the lockup could be legally punished. Mr. Hardwick thought it should be treated as a theft of a portion of a dead body, but my uncle fancied there was a penalty for mutilation of a dead body per se, though he could not point to the statute. As it happened, however, they were saved the trouble of arriving at a decision, for in the morning he was discovered to have escaped. He had been left, of course, with free hands, and had occupied the night in wrenching out the bars at the top of the back wall of the little prison shed. It had stood on the green for 150 years, and climbing out, he was not found again. And a month or two later, the Foster family left the district entirely. Join me next week for a case of curious clues on the locked room. In the meantime, beware of footsteps in the dark.